Radical love, lavish generosity, extravagant forgiveness, inclusive hospitality, compassionate action, selfless service, a passion for justice, creative nonviolence, simple living. Good day, good people. I'm Robert Farrell. This is Coalesce. Thank you for joining me. Coalesce is grounded in both and thinking, heart wisdom, and listening for the common good arising in dialogue, where we are present to presence. Coalesce provides an opportunity to encounter and discover the multiple perspectives that make our beautiful community. May we see with the eyes of our heart. May we love one another with peace and compassion. May all beings come to know the divine presence within. This is episode 9, Biased from the Bottom. Starting with Deuteronomy 7, verses 7 through 9. If Yahweh set his heart on you and chose you, it was not because you were greater than any other people, but in fact, you were the least of all the peoples. But Yahweh is a faithful God who is true to his graciousness for 1,000 generations. One of the great themes of the Bible, which begins in the Hebrew Scriptures and is continued in Jesus, is the preferential option for the poor, or the bias from the bottom. About 1,200 years before Christ, Israel was at the bottom, an enslaved people in Egypt. The Exodus, the great journey of the Hebrew people out of slavery and finally into the Promised Land, is an archetype of the interior spiritual journey from entrapment to liberation. It's the universal story. Moses, a murderer on the run and caring for his father-in-law's sheep, himself a man at the bottom. Moses first encounters God in a burning bush, Exodus 3:2, which, like so many initial religious experiences, is experienced alone, externally and yet interiorly as well, both earth-based and transcendent at the same time. Take off your shoes, this is holy ground, Exodus 3:5. This religious experience is immediately followed by a call to a very costly social concern for his own oppressed people, whom he had not cared about up till then. God said, I have heard the groaning of my people in Egypt. You, Moses, are to go confront the Pharaoh and tell him to let my people go. Exodus 3:9-10. There, right at the beginning of the Judeo-Christian tradition, is the perfect integration of action and contemplation. First, the contemplative experience comes, the burning bush, and immediately it has social, economic, and political implications. The connection is clear. There is no authentic God experience that does not situate you in the world in a different way. After an encounter with presence, you see things differently, and it gives you the security to be free from your usual loyalties, the system that you had lived in, your economics, and your tribe. Your screen of life expands exponentially. I believe the Exodus story, with Moses and the Jewish people, is the root of all liberation theology, which Jesus clearly exemplifies in the Synoptic Gospels. See Luke 4:18-19. Liberation theology focuses on freeing people from religious, political, social, and economic oppression, i.e. what Pope John Paul II called structural sin and institutional evil. It goes beyond just trying to free individuals from their own particular naughty behaviors, which is what sin has seemed to mean for most Christian people in our individualistic culture. Liberation theology, instead of legitimating the status quo, tries to read reality, history, and the Bible not from the side of the powerful, but from the side of the pain. Its beginning point is not sin management, but where is the suffering? This makes all the difference in how we read the Bible. God sees all the main kinds of suffering in the world. The world tends to define poverty and riches simply in terms of economics. But poverty has many faces: weakness, dependence, or humiliation. Essentially, poverty is a lack of means to accomplish what one desires, be it lack of money, relationship, influence, power, intellectual ability, physical strength, freedom, or dignity. Scriptures promise that God will take care of such people because they know they have to rely on God. The idioms right and left came from the States General in France, where to the right of the throne sat the nobility and the clergy. Interesting how the clergy moved over there, given Jesus' poverty. And on the left sat the commoners, over 90% of the French population at that time. I suspect that some form of the right is necessary for order and continuity in a culture, and some form of left is necessary for truth and reform in a culture. You need them both, and they recur in every culture in some form. It is only dualistic thinkers who cannot see this. In the biblical tradition, these two poles are symbolized by the kings, priests, and the prophets, beginning with the Egyptian Pharaoh and the first prophet, Moses. There is a necessary tension between the kingly, priestly worldview and the prophetic worldview. There is only one instance in the Hebrew Scriptures that those two ever make friends, and then only barely. This is when David the king accepts the critique of Nathan the prophet after Nathan accuses David of his deceit, violence, and corruption. David has the humility to admit, "I have sinned against the Lord." 2 Samuel 12, verse 13. However, he does not chop Nathan's head off, which is the norm in all of literature. It is this action that sets David on a course toward wholeness and holiness. But it is rare. The right considers itself the product of rationality, experience, and civilization. The left normally takes shape in people's movements arising out of high-minded ideology or unbearable injustices, and often both. The left's movements are not rational or well-planned at the beginning. They are intuitive and come from the suffering of the little people, who are of no account and have no press, power, or status. Thus, they rely on symbols, songs, slogans, and charismatic leaders to get off the ground. The biblical pattern of Exodus, prophets taking on empires, has been repeated time and again in history. Gandhi and Martin Luther King Jr. would be outstanding examples of such prophets in our time, and we all know how their stories ended. Only in Oscar Romero, Nelson Mandela, and now Pope Francis do we begin to see the two normal oppositions begin to work together in one person. Romero was both prophet and bishop. Mandela was both prophet and president. And Pope Francis is both prophet and pope. I am not aware of any previous pope that I would call a prophet. non-dual thinking and non-dual spirituality are finally emerging in our time. Let us pause for 1 minute in silence to connect with at least one person on the edge. With our eyes closed and hands on heart, rest in the silence. Be still for 1 minute. Most of political and church history has been controlled and written by people on the right because they, more than those on the left, have the access, the power, and the education to write books and get them published. One of the few subversive texts in history, believe it or not, is the Bible. The Bible is most extraordinary because it repeatedly and invariably legitimizes the people on the bottom and not the people on the top. The rejected son, the barren woman, the sinner, the leper, or the outsider who is always the one chosen of God. Please do not take my word on this. Check it out. It is rather obvious, but for some reason, the obvious needs to be pointed out to us. In every case, we are presented with some form of powerlessness. And from that situation, God creates a new kind of power. That is the constant pattern hidden in plain sight. So many barren women are mentioned in the Hebrew Scriptures that you begin to wonder if there was a problem with the water. Sarah, Abraham's wife, was barren and old too before God blessed her with baby Isaac, Genesis 17. 15 through 19. Rachel, Jacob's wife, was barren before God opened her womb and she bore Joseph, Genesis 30, 22 through 24. Barren Hannah poured out her soul before the Lord and God gave her Samuel, see 1 Samuel 1. Even before Moses, God chose a nobody, Abraham, and made him a somebody. God chose Jacob over Esau, even though Esau is the elder and more earnest son, and Jacob is a shifty, even deceitful character. Election has nothing to do with worthiness, but only usability. And in the Bible, usability ironically comes from facing one's own wrongness or littleness, as we see in Mary. God chose Saul to be king out of the tribe of Benjamin, the smallest and weakest tribe in Israel. The pattern does seem to be that the last will be first and the first will be last, Matthew 20:16. One of the most dramatic biblical stories in this regard is the story of David. God chose David, the youngest and least experienced son of Jesse, to be king over the nation. Jesse had never even mentioned him as a possibility, but left him out in the fields, 1 Samuel 16. In fact, he was a totally forgotten son, who then finds his power on a new level. Yahweh evened up the odds, 1 Samuel 17, and David, just a young boy with a slingshot, powerlessness, brought the giant Goliath, power, down. This is the constant pattern of redemptive suffering and trial that finds its final revelation on the cross, where Jesus is abject powerlessness, and in this very state redeems the world. God's bias toward the little ones, the powerless, and those on the bottom has been rediscovered by those who learn to see deeply and with compassion. Francis of Assisi, Thérèse of Lisieux, Mother Teresa, and 12-step spirituality being well-known examples, but even they are usually marginalized by the establishment mind and the right. Notice the shock when a pope took the name of a non-establishment saint, Francis. In almost all of history, the vast majority of people understood the view from the bottom due to their own life circumstance. Most of the people who have ever lived on this planet have been oppressed and poor, but their history was seldom written except in the Bible, until very recently in such books as Howard Zinn's A People's History of the United States. Only in modern times and wealthy countries do we find the strange phenomenon of the masses of people having an establishment mentality. This relatively new thing called the middle class gives many of us just enough comfort not to have to feel the pinch or worry about injustice for ourselves. Only by solidarity with other people's suffering can comfortable people be converted. Otherwise, they are disconnected from the cross, of the world, of others, of Jesus, and finally of their own necessary participation in the great mystery of dying and rising. Most of us in the Northern Hemisphere have a view from the top, even though we are nowhere near the top ourselves. The mass of people can normally be bought off by giving them just enough bread and circuses, as the Romans said. In the early Christian scriptures, or the New Testament, we clearly see that it's mostly the lame, the poor, the blind, the prostitutes, the drunkards, the tax collectors, the sinners, those on the bottom and the outside, that really hear Jesus' teachings and get the point and respond to him. It's the readers and insiders, the priests, scribes, Pharisees, teachers of the law, and Roman leaders who crucify him. Check this out if you do not believe me. How did we miss such a core point? Most of Christian history kept the point from hitting home by blaming the Jews. Power was the problem, not the Jews. When Christians have all the power, they do the same thing, and we also would have crucified Jesus if he had critiqued the Catholic Church or the Protestant Church or any church the way he did his own religion. After Jesus' death and resurrection, the first Christians are largely underground. They are the persecuted ones, meeting in secrecy in the catacombs. During this time, we see a lot of good interpretation of the scriptures, with a liberationist worldview, i.e., a view from the bottom. You could say that at that time, we were largely a church of the poor and for the poor. The turning point at which the church moved from the bottom to the top is the year 313, when Emperor Constantine thinks he's doing us a great favor by beginning to make Christianity the established religion of the Holy Roman Empire. That's how the Apostolic Church became Roman Catholicism. We got all linked up with the imperial worldviews, and our perspective changed from the view from the bottom and powerlessness, the persecuted, the outsiders, to the view from the top, where we were now the ultimate insiders, power, money, status, and control. And emperors convened and controlled most of the early councils of the church, not bishops or popes. That is verifiable history. Sadly, most did not see the problem with that, and many still don't. Many saints along the way still tried to be a church for the poor, but from a somewhat superior and safe stance. It is only in some form of actual solidarity with the outsiders, sinners, little ones, that we fully get the message of the gospel. It is only then that we understand our own poor soul and its neediness. Let us pause for 1 minute in silence to connect with at least one person on the edge. With eyes closed and hands on heart, rest in the silence. Be still for 1 minute. Corinthians 1:27. God chose things the world considers foolish in order to shame those who think they are wise. And he chose things that are powerless to shame those who are powerful. In all honesty, once it was on top and fully part of the establishment, the church was a bit embarrassed by the powerless one, Jesus. We had to make his obvious defeat into a glorious victory that had nothing to do with defeat, his or ours. Let's face it, we feel more comfortable with power than with powerlessness. Who wants to be like Jesus on the cross, the very icon of powerlessness? It just doesn't look like a way of influence, a way of access, a way that's going to make any difference in the world. We are such a strange religion. We worship this naked, bleeding loser crucified outside the walls of Jerusalem. But we always want to be the winners, powerful, and on top ourselves, at least until we learn to love the little things and the so-called little people. And then we often see that they are not little at all, but better images of the soul. Yet those with mental and physical disabilities, minority groups, refugees, the addicted, the homosexual, the prisoner, anybody who's failed in our nicely constructed social or economic success system can be our best teachers in the ways of the gospel. They represent what we are most afraid of within ourselves. What we most deny within ourselves. That's why we must learn to love our enemy. We absolutely must, or we will never know how to love our own soul, or the soul of anything. Please think about that until it makes sense to you. It eventually will, by the grace of God. One of the most transformative experiences is entering into some form of lifestyle solidarity with the powerless. It's like changing sides from the ego side of things, and this is what changes you. We don't think ourselves into a new way of living. We live ourselves into a new way of thinking. It is lifestyle choices that convert people. I am not aware that merely believing a doctrine or dogma has ever converted anybody, and that should be obvious by now. Someone once pointed out to me that most of the great founders of communities, including Francis of Assisi, Mother Catherine Drexel, Vincent de Paul, Benedict, John Baptist de La Salle, and Mother Seton, all started out as what we would now call middle class or even upper class. They first had enough comfort and security and leisure to move beyond their need for comfort and security and leisure because they saw it did not satisfy or feed the soul. Each in their own way changed sides and worked in solidarity with those who did not have their advantages. When the right moves towards the left, while including what they learned on the right, we often have the best of both worlds. People who are in early stage religion usually love the two steps backwards quotes in the Bible. They seem to be drawn toward anything that's punitive, shame-based, exclusionary of wrong people, or anything that justifies the status quo, which just happens to be keeping them on top, socially, economically, and religiously. They start by thinking that's what religion is about, maintaining order and social control. God is sort of a glorified Miss Manners. They emphasize the almighty, all-powerful nature of God, who is made into the great policeman in the sky to keep us all under control, or at least everybody else under control. Now you see how revolutionary God's new idea is that was revealed in Jesus. Suddenly, we have a God that is anything but a policeman, a God who finds grace in those who break the law and finds life and freedom among the lepers and the sinners who do not have good manners. This is now an upside-down universe. And I'm sad to say most Christians have yet to participate in this divine revolution. Mature religious people, that is, those who develop an actual inner life of prayer and outer life of service, tend to notice and imitate the three steps forward quotes in the Bible. First, they change their life stance, and then they can be entrusted with the Bible. For all others who will not change their life position, the Bible is mere information and ammunition. It would be better if they did not read it. Only converted people who are in union with both the pain of the world and the love of God are prepared to read the Bible with the right pair of eyes and the appropriate bias, which is from the side of powerlessness and suffering, instead of the side of power and control. This is foundational and essential conversion, and it is the biblical characters themselves that reveal this pattern, which then becomes obvious as you look around the world that we live in. The Greek world, ineffectively translated as repentance in the Bible, quite literally means to change your mind. Metanoia, which is what the season of Lent is supposed to be about. It is not about giving up candy. You can give up all the candy you want and still be trapped in the old mind. You can give up no candy at all and still allow yourself a total revolution of the mind. Ephesians 4:23. That is what Lent is about. Let us pause for 1 minute in silence to connect with at least one person on the edge. With eyes closed and hands on heart, rest in the silence. Be still for 1 minute. This week's practice is standing in solidarity. Tim Shriver is the chair of Special Olympics, and he wrote a passage on this theme of bias from the bottom. The practice this week is just to read his words. Imagine how you might stand in solidarity with someone on the edge, someone who has been excluded, and see that individual through God's eyes. I'll read the passage now. Throughout Scripture, there is a call for social justice, meaning social equality, inclusion of those on the edge. It is a deeply spiritual call, and yet it has a powerful and important political function. Those on the edge hold the key to healing and uniting the whole system, to unite with those who are the most vulnerable, the most excluded, is the critical social dimension of unitive consciousness and community. You cannot believe in or practice unitive consciousness as long as you exclude and marginalize others. Whether it is women, or people of different sexual orientations, or people of religious or ethnic minorities, or, in my experience, people with intellectual disabilities. For 20 years, I have been mentored by these same people. Some might not be the best spoken, the most articulate writers, the most celebrated thinkers, the fastest runners. And yet, despite all of that, I have met person after person who emanates a kind of radiant light. After a while, even the densest of us may have our eyes open to that something which transcends all superficial distractions of disability, the unimaginable beauty of every person. That beauty is ours for the seeing if only we have the eyes to see, if only we pay attention. Many times I've watched, for instance, as a person with Down syndrome stands with a gold medal around her neck, arms raised high to a cheering crowd. I can't look at that child, at that human being, without slipping out of dualistic thinking. Those moments are a kind of sacrament of unitive consciousness. They are both and moments where shadow and light coexist in the same experience. Divine energy shoots vertically through me like a force and says, "See, look, pay attention to what is right in front of you. That is all you need to know." Thank you, friends, for being with me. May the longtime sun shine upon you, all love surround you, and the pure light within you guide your way on.